Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Andrew Sheng and Ira Harris. Andrew is the Distinguished Fellow of the Asia Global Institute at the University of Hong Kong and a former chairman of the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. He's worked for the central banks in Malaysia and in Hong Kong, and he advises to several sovereign wealth funds. His latest book is Shadow Banking in China. And Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a period also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's glad to be here, Richard. Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your thoughts, Andrew, on the current challenges of the Asian economy and the global economy in this post-COVID era.
Well, the world is in a mess. That's no doubt about it. This is a pandemic of the century. The last one was the Spanish flu in 1918. The basic lesson we learned from this pandemic is if you don't control the virus controls you. So the damage from the pandemic is huge. There are now millions infected. The world is most of the world is on negative growth for this year. The good news is that the vaccines have been now more or less discovered and on release. But the world has changed dramatically in 2020. The major issue is that central banks have come into a class of their own. They increased their balance sheets by roughly $7 trillion. The governments, according to the IMF, pumped roughly $12 trillion into the economies to rescue the economies and the effects of the pandemic. And so we now have global debt, the highest ever. The United States debt rose from something like 70% of GDP now to about 100%. Every country's debt has increased. Interest rates are historically low. The question, therefore, is how is going to be sustainable? Now, on East Asia, the good news is that East Asia was the first to get into the crisis, the pandemic, first to be hit, first to control it, and first to emerge. So China will be the first major economy to have positive growth in 2020. Everybody seems to be bullish over 2021. There is no doubt from a statistical point of view, if you start from a low level, growth will be upwards. But my guess is that the markets are outrunning the reality. The reason is that the bottom half of society is ravaged. I think that's the only word we can use. There is carnage out there for small and medium enterprises and people who cannot go online and therefore are losing jobs, losing their health insurance, don't know where the next paycheck and their food is going to come from. And this is not just in the advanced markets. This is very much in the emerging markets. So the world is facing huge challenges, and finance has a lot to do with this because the stock markets are booming. The Dow has, gone over 30,000. The S&P 500 index completely tracks the balance sheets of the four largest central banks. If the balance sheets of the central banks expands, the stock market just goes up. If the balance sheet of the central banks declines, the stock market goes down. So it's a key question. It's no longer a free market. It's all about central bank money.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, Richard, I agree with Andrew wholeheartedly. And, we're on the Financial Repression Authority. So the game is on, and it's been on. And as you and I have been talking for the last 4 or 5 years already. And, you know, my many times with Rick Santelli, we talk about the central banks have totally broken the market mechanism of the bond markets, and everything starts from there. And then everything just resides in the equity markets. And now, especially, and they're all following. I mean, I listened to Lagarde's comments today, and they're consistent. And even Kuroda, they're all, it's like they just read each other's speeches, cut and paste a little bit here and there. They should all be fired for plagiarism, because all they do is steal from each other to convey to the markets that, hey, we're not going anywhere. And it's really, as you know, some people take offense at it, but I say that the Fed has now become the Ministry of Social Justice, because as Andrew talks about, the people who really are suffering the most are the ones who Powell uses as the backdrop. And I'm not saying that it's disingenuous on his part whatsoever. He's got great concerns about, as he says, those who are the last hired and first fired. And until they're back to where they were with growing wages and basically unemployment, especially for minority populations, is back down to the record lows, they're not moving, because his continual reiteration of the phrase, through no fault of their own. So once you take on the concept of through no fault of their own, you are now obligated to pursue this continual monetary policy. Now, from a moral standpoint, I happen to agree with them, but I do not want my financial centerpiece taking that role. That is not their role. So, and that's where we really get into a very difficult situation. And I'm hoping that we'll get into a little bit of the conversation, because now that Yellen has been, that Janet Yellen has been put forth as Secretary of Treasury, and I happen to think it's a good pick, because she's always been, being a labor economist, she was always a moral philosopher. And I blogged for the years that she was Fed chair that, you know, she was the one who embarked upon the Fed Listens, and she, you know, took that to, by her as her mantra to try to improve the employment situation. But once you go down that road, you go down into a very, very soft monetary policy, because now you're focused on that. You can tell me that you're pursuing a dual mandate. Of course, I think the Fed has a triple mandate, which is jobs, inflation, and then the preservation of the global financial system because of the reserve role of the dollar. So you have now committed yourself. For how long? Don't know. But that's where they hide behind forward guidance. And that's what's turned the bond markets topsy-turvy. I mean, nothing says it more than if you look at Italian and Greek 10-year debt yielding 20 basis points less, so to speak, than U.S. 10-year debt, when those were two of the worst credits in Europe. But the markets are just broken. And that's so I agree. It's a long response to Andrew's point.
Well, I agree with Ira. The issue is that at very low or negative interest rates, the function of the price of money as an efficient allocator of resource allocation is broken. So the question is, what is this replacement? And the answer is, we don't know. We used to say we believe the market. Okay, we believe the market because the market interest rate reflects the underlying price of money. And then the risk spread reflects the risk. And as Ira has pointed out, some companies, some banks, some emerging market bonds simply do not reflect the risks. The price, the returns don't reflect the risks. So you have to need your head examined to buy some of these long-term paper. You know, knowing that history tells us that inflation always returns when you print that kind of money. So So this is why what has happened is a natural response of the masses, which are the bulk of the people, right, who put their money in the banking deposits. They realize they earn zero interest rates, But now the middle class, who used to rely on, you know, long-term bank deposits and long-term bonds to give them a steady income, is now earning nothing. So if they're going to earn nothing and they think that they're going to lose everything with the return of inflation, they are piling into equity markets. And that's why the equity markets are now not reflecting the reality on the situation. And we now have a very fundamental question that questions finance theory. Does the stock market predict the future? Now, if the stock market is as where it is today, it seems that we've got a very bright future ahead of us. But if you really look at the real economy is in a mess. And as Ira says, until the middle class and the bottom half of society actually get decent income, the real economy won't recover. You know, the rich country economies depends upon consumption. And if the rich, who are getting richer by the day because of zero interest rates and asset inflation, they don't need to consume so much, right? And so, you know, their consumption, plus the fact that, in fact, people are saving even more because they can't consume, the economy can only go slower. And the second point is that, as we've now seen, productivity still is going down because nobody's thinking long-term. Everybody is doing short-term speculation. And therefore, the productivity keeps on going down despite so-called technology increases, innovation. And so we're looking at literal, you know, a very bleak stagflation period, which means that the issue is not about fiscal policy or monetary policy. It's really about the structural policy, is how do you get the economy going again, and how do you create jobs? Now, the fact that monetary policy can support this, you know, is not a bad idea, right? But to think that the monetary policy can push growth and push employment, the theory there is definitely broken.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Oh, I can't agree more. And in pure economic terms, and Andrew raises an interesting point. It was, you know, when we talked with Lacey Hunt, who sees the deflationary fears from the continuation of piling on of debt. And it's interesting that today, or over the weekend, we got the numbers again from the International Institute of Finance. And in 2020, global debt to GDP has grown from 320% to 365%. That's a 45% increase in debt. Now, of course, I know that global GDP has declined, so some of that is due to that, but that's monstrous. But the fear of it, and what the stock markets are doing, because, you know, they're just, as I explained to to people who I know, and they say, well, what should I do? You know, I don't want to have to invest in the stock market. And I tell them, okay, so let's, you know, use the hypothetical. Let's say, you know, you're close to retirement, you have $500,000, let's say, in saving. If you put it in the bank, how much do you think you're going to earn this year? You know, and for people who are not astute, I go, how about $500? They laugh.
Correct.
I go, don't laugh. That's if you're lucky. So then I said, so you're better off going to buy some high quality companies with some dividends. And if you, you know, build your own portfolio, you sparse it out. If you wind up making like right now, the market is just riding this sea of liquidity. It's a global basis. It generates massive, you know, so if you get yourself 6, 7, 8%, if you only invest half of that, $250,000 in equity, and leave the rest in some short-term bonds. So if you get, so now you've at least generated a return of, you know, $20,000. Well, that's far ahead of where you were. And yet that's still not all that great when people think about their retirement. So these are, and what we keep doing is, as economists would term, intertemporal dislocation. We keep bringing demand forward. And then we wonder why when the economy turns around, we only get a 1 or 2% growth factor. Because if I'm a corporation, I'm not investing in technology. I don't need more plant. I'm so uncertain about the demand picture as we go forward. Why? I'll make do with the capital investment that I have. I don't have to enhance it at this time. Although as a society, especially in America, we do need massive infrastructure spending. So we need to just quit distributing money and running deficits to supplant consumption and actually start doing some real investment that will bear fruit going forward.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think investment in infrastructure is where it should be because that's indirectly investing in your people. Okay, the fact that if you're a poor guy, man or woman, and you can't access Wi-Fi, you're denied online trading. You're denied online communications, and you're denied the gig economy. And so, what happens? You've got to go out there and catch COVID, working in all the dirty jobs that nobody wants, and being underpaid. And so, the risks have all been passed to the bottom half of society, and that's unsustainable. So if you get your infrastructure going, it will really help not just America, but everywhere else in the world. And that's the sad part about it. The central banks say that we can create money, but we don't want to get involved in resource allocation. But we've moved the interest rate to zero, and the interest rate resource allocator is broken. So who's deciding where those money goes? That's the key question, right? So it's not about the debt. The issue is about where is the asset? It's all right if you have debt, if you invested in good assets. Now, good assets, I mean, people who are educated and infrastructure, which delivers productivity for people. But if all the money is just going for spending, for politics or whatever, and for gambling, as Keynes used to say, you won't have a good outcome, and we're only postponing the inevitable.
And in terms of central bank policies, Andrew, what are your thoughts on yield curve control?
Well, the yield curve control is just a tool, right? You just keep on buying the long bond, and if you buy the long bond, and that was the classic story of the free market economists, if central banks buy the long bond, what happens to the interest rate? Does the interest rate reflect true market conditions, or it reflects the desire of the central bank to keep the interest rate at a particular point of time? And if the central bank decides to keep the interest rate as a point of time, are we dealing with a free market or are we dealing with a central bank driven market? So the central bankers cannot have their cake and eat it. They're saying that we operate in a free market, but you are now $40 trillion, which is larger than global pension funds and larger than global, the mutual funds, slightly smaller, but, getting there as the central banks increase. So the fact that central banks are now using free market theory, but intervening in a huge way, has created huge moral hazard in the system. The long bond yield curves do not reflect underlying market conditions. I mean, anybody who is willing to hold very long bonds, is assuming at near zero interest rates, is assuming that inflation will not return over this 10 to 30 years. And that must be crazy. Short term, I agree, inflation may not come back because there's huge excess capacity. But in the long run, at the rate we are printing money, there's no way inflation will not come back. There's an excellent book by Professor Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan on this, about the great demographic reversal. Basically, they are saying that inflation was nearly eliminated or sharply reduced because the supply shock of China, this humongous economy, increasing massive supply to the global economy, right? And it was a demographic dividend. Now that China is aging, China will become a more consumer, less a saver. Liquidity will not be so much forthcoming. So inflation is only a matter of time. I agree with that thesis in direction, but my own hunch is that inflation will come back in the emerging markets first, because emerging markets are more related to consumer price index, and food and essentials are a much larger component of these CPIs. And so, you know, with climate change, you will get water shocks from drought, storms, rising seas, and therefore food shocks. And therefore, inflation in the emerging markets will rise. And if the emerging markets rise, their exchange rate will be impacted, and eventually it will filter through to the advanced markets. Now, advanced markets, you know, currently food and all these prices are not so important because, you know, they're more than self-sufficient, like the United States. But if you carry on printing money like this, inflation is a matter of time. So the challenge facing the new Treasury Secretary is how to get the infrastructure and the long-term investments going so that the long-term productivity of the U.S. economy recovers back to its old trajectory. Now, it may not for quite a while, but at least, you know, the fiscal and the structural policies are being implemented.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I can't agree more. That's where it all lies. And where's it going to go? I don't know. But, you know, this is the same discussion that we've had since December of 2019, when I scoffed at bond buyers, when we did that Rosenberg, that wasn't the Four Horsemen, that was later this year. That was in May, I think, or this year. Yeah. But when I did that Rosenberg, and they proved to be very right to be long bonds, because bonds, the long end of the curve, you know, had big returns this year. But I challenged, you know, my thought about that was, would you have gotten those returns in the bond market without COVID? And would you have gotten the returns in the equity market without COVID? Because I believe that the interest rate factor pushed both. And the Fed's massive intervening into the bond markets, which, you know, helped resolve that, you know, also. So, you know, there are a lot of things that drove it this year that I think we're going to – I'm hard-pressed to buy a U.S. 10-year at 85 basis points. I'm hard-pressed. There would be – first of all, in order to get that, you will have to go into a deflationary period. Well, to me, and I've been adamant about this, if you get a deflationary – a true deflationary spiral, which – would be disastrous, the Fed would be deemed an absolute failure by their policies. And, you know, as Andrew talked about what will happen in emerging market currencies and other currency markets, the Fed, you know, through the use of the swap lines starting in last March and April, but then, of course, the swap lines were wound down by late June because they had met what they were meant to do, which was to cure the shortage of dollars in the world because of the huge amount of debt and the fact that most of it was dollar denominated. So they did, and they accomplished that. We've seen the dollar go down. I can time it to May 25th when the euro started to reverse. And to me, that was off of Wolfgang Schäuble's great pivot, calling for fiscal stimulus and rather than austerity. So, I mean, we've had a lot of things happen this year, but I'm an Andrews guy. I wouldn't buy. I'll trade the bonds from all, because I'm a trader. I think like a long-term investor. I act as a trader. So I'll trade from the long side because I know that the Fed and the ECB, you know, the BOJ is interesting because we're not sure what they're doing. You know, in order to trade the world's second largest bond market, you have to call and make an appointment because it doesn't really trade. So you see how a central bank can absolutely undermine the market mechanism of a bond market, because they've done that in Japan. But I don't know when the Fed buys $120 billion a month in assets. 120, that's not rolling over. That's new purchases of one sort or another. It's hard to play the short side of the bond market, as I would like to do, and I think I hear Andrew's voice, he would like to do. But, you know, as they famously referred to the JGB market as the widowmaker, now every sovereign debt market of a developed country falls prey to the mechanism of central bank intervention. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult to price capital in this environment, right? Capital is really priced inefficiently, as we see that even non-investment grade bonds trade at ridiculously low levels. Because why? Because there's been no defaults. So if you price it to no defaults, well, there's no defaults because there's a lot of, as the Japanese will explain to you, a lot of zombie companies that exist. And beyond that, and because they've pushed bond prices so far down, or bond yields, I should say, a lot of companies stay afloat because they can afford the VIG, so to speak. But they're all hoping to get bailed out by a huge spurt in nominal GDP. I'm not in that camp yet, and I'm forced into the equity market, you know, through the acronym TINA, which I can't stand. Through there is no alternative, but find me an alternative. You know, how many Ferraris can you buy? How many Picassos can you own? You know, it's so you eventually are by default wind up in the equity markets.
Well, if you really look at the BOJ's balance sheet, the BOJ owns 50% of the JGBs out there. And, you know, they own 75% of the Nikkei index ETFs. Why? Because, you know, at some point of time, it's the only game in town as far as the equity market is concerned. Now, for a lot of people have not paid too much attention to why the Fed suddenly increased the their balance sheet in March. Now, it was blamed on the COVID market, blame on the pandemic. And I agree the pandemic was the trigger. But actually, if you really read the Financial Stability Board's analysis of the March 2020 incident events, it revealed that the non-bank financial intermediaries the banking system account for only less than one quarter of the balance sheet of the U.S. financial system, excluding the Fed, which means that actually in March 2020, the Fed was lending massively to the banks to bail out the non-bank financial intermediaries, mostly the index funds, the passive funds, and the money market funds, because they were going to tank. And if they were going to tank, they were going to massively sell the stock market and the bond market, which would then create a massive crash. Now, that's where the too big to fail matter is. The U.S. stock market is 181% of GDP. That was before it reached 30,000. Now, you just think about it. 30% decline in the stock market is 54% decline in wealth. 54% of GDP decline for the United States, which is a massive, you know, asset shock, not only on the United States, but on the rest of the world. So, you know, not allowing that stock market to crash was the moral hazard that the Fed undertook in March 2020, disguised as it was due to the pandemic. Yes, the pandemic triggered it. But, you know, the Fed injected that money and then said, well, you know, that money was really being used to help out on the pandemic issue, but it really was to prevent a massive stock market meltdown. Okay, that prevented it, and it wasn't a bad thing in the sense that it prevented a massive global financial crisis. But how long can King Canute prevent the tide from coming back in?
That's If I may, yeah, that's really well said. And they did. They prevented it. And I get it. You know what? For those who, you know, if we go back to the 20s and 30s and Andrew Mellon, you know, when he was, you know, Secretary of Treasury, you know, liquidate, liquidate, liquidate. There will be no liquidation. You know, Rick Santelli and I argued this in 08 when Rick was with famously with the Tea Party. But I said, you cannot get into a liquidation mode because the United States, especially political system, cannot tolerate 25% unemployment. Can't happen. You will not happen. So I understood QE1. After that, I got lost. But Andrew talks about the Financial Stability Board, which really it's one of my favorite places to go to read. And William White, who's one of my favorite central bank economists, just had a recent piece out about the central banks keep shooting themselves in the foot. And this is all this iteration because they really have no exit strategy, right? Every time the central banks try to get into an exit mode, let's go back to, and Andrew's point is very well taken, because if we go back to the fourth quarter of 2018, when the Fed was busy shrinking the balance sheet and raising the Fed funds rate, by Christmas of 2018, you had Mnuchin calling up Wall Street banks over Christmas Eve, wondering if anyone was in trouble. And then in January 2019, we get Powell doing the Powell pivot and reversing what had been that policy. And why? And I think Andrew hits this right on the head. Because there were the risk parity trades were starting to melt down. And those were enormous positions. And not only, you know, people forget, but when it's not only AQR or Ray Dalio, Bridgewater, or, you know, five other or six other funds who are mimicking that successful trades, but it's all the banks who are tailcoding them, because that's what the prime broker system is all about, is that, hey, I'm going to lend you the money, but I get a look at what your investment strategies are. So the positions were enormous, and I don't think the Fed had any idea. You know, this was no longer a shadow banking issue. This was that, in a real sense, that the compilation and aggregation of these positions as one was following another was about to cause a massive meltdown of the entire financial system. And COVID just led to, as we saw in March and April, to a redo of it and enhanced and increased the pain of it. So I Andrew, I think, is just dead point right on.
And on the infrastructure and fiscal stimulus we've referred to, given the current infrastructure initiatives being looked at by governments in terms of Agenda 2030, the European Recovery Fund, World Economic Forum, Great Reset, will these initiatives be able to generate sufficient jobs and economic activity to bring back the economy levels at the beginning of this year pre-COVID, or will more infrastructure fiscal stimulus be required? Andrew?
Well, you must remember, infrastructures are not that easy to start. They take, you know, just design from design to actually laying down the foundations of a bridge or dam or whatever you call it, is 2 to 3 years, right? So if you want to, you know, build the high-speed rail throughout the United States, you're talking about a 10 to 15-year project, right? And then so, you know, just starting it, you know, is going to be slow. So the real area where the world must get its act together is trade. Now, in the last 4 years, we're still undergoing a trade war, and it ain't over yet. So the danger is that global trade will still shrink because of lack of aggregate demand worldwide. The Chinese have already decided that if everybody's going to attack China or blame China for everything, they're concentrating on doing their own thing, which means that they can go for domestic consumption. and they will trade with whoever is willing to be their trading partner and just keep their head low. But that's not going to stimulate the whole world economy. That means the idea that China would step up in 2009 to reflate the world is gone. G20 talks a lot, but there's not really that much cooperative action. All the numbers that they say is actually individual countries are doing their own thing. So if the world does not focus on trade, which is the immediate stimulus to the global economy, I'm afraid we're going to talk each other down into another recession and if not depression. That's my real worry. It's not that infrastructure is not the right way to go. It is the right way to go. But the reality is that in democratic countries, it's not so fast to get your economy going again. And trade is the right way to go. But for geopolitical reasons, very few people are thinking through this. And as long as everybody blames each other, you won't get global cooperation. And we need to understand the world is very complicated. It is a systemic problem. No single country can solve the global system problem. And we have to work together. Unfortunately, the world is no longer talking to each other. They're all talking across each other. And therefore, I'm not that optimistic on this. But I sincerely hope that everybody will sit down and talk. That's my hope. Now, you know, but realistically, I think the chances of not talking is higher than talking. But I'm praying that the second part will happen.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I guess we're coming to the end here. So, and we talked before. You know, I think that the Biden election, right now he's moving to the center. He's got Janet Yellen, who I think, again, is a very good pick. And the United States is going to pile on massive amounts of debts because they're going to, you know, it's just like in 1946 to 51 during the Accord, which was necessary as a basically controlled the long end of the curve because U.S. had to pay down. They had borrowed all this money and they couldn't afford for interest rates to go higher. So, of course, financial repression was the rule of the day. And people who had bought government savings bonds to support the country during times of war, while some people put their lives on the line, they put their savings on the line, and they got financially repressed. I think we're going to be in that now. We're going to have the Democrats are going to declare a war against wealth inequality, and with that, another war on poverty, to borrow from Lyndon Johnson. And with that, you're going to need yield curve control. So my proposal to the Fed, if I was Jerome Powell, I would offer my resignation to Biden, and I would do it with grace, because everybody thinks Powell did this great job, so he can leave like Michael Jordan with 6 championship rings and at the top of his game. And then Biden can appoint Leo Brainard, who has been at the vanguard of yield curve control. Now, the Fed has stopped talking about yield curve control since August, but November 26, 2019, and then in, April, May, and June, and even July, Brainard was out. In most of the speeches she gave, she talked about, well, the yield curve control may become a necessitated tool. And she was really, again, at the vanguard of it. So if they're going to go down this path, they cannot let the long end yields rise, because that'll wind up in severe political difficulties, because the ability to finance this massive debt buildup in the United States, and it's going to grow even more. Now, of course, we haven't gotten anything yet from that second COVID stimulus, but it's going to grow. And if you allowed rates to rise, you would wind up making political decisions, because you'd have to cut all these discretionary spending programs in order to pay the interest on the growing debt. So by definition, you need yield curve control. So if Powell sees this, you know, I think that's the route the United States has to go down. And as people were talking about today, Yellen need not have a dollar policy, by the way. I think it's a mistake. It's the Treasury's job, of course, and not the Fed. But, you know, every once in a while, if she wants to talk about it. But the world right now doesn't need a stronger dollar, by the way. No way. And if you want to get some, you know, that money illusion, as Irving Fisher would call it, through inflation. And even Rogoff and others have argued that nothing would relieve some of the global debt than, you know, a race up in nominal GDP. So I think that's what the world is going to look forward to. And I think Andrew makes a very good point. How do we time it? I don't know. It takes longer than we think. But where David Rosenberg rightly argued last December when we did that discussion, well, there's not enough workers to do any infrastructure spending programs anyway. Well, we've certainly resolved that issue, as Andrew started the whole conversation talking about. There's plenty of workers available. So if you're going to do it now, you know, is make haste. Don't wait this one out and really get some infrastructure investment, because, boy, the Western economies not only need it from a stimulative point of view, they need it because they've allowed infrastructure to deteriorate massively over the last 20, 25 years. So that's the way I see the world. And nothing sustains it more than looking at the price of copper, because to me, copper is rising not for anything that we're actually doing, but people are hoarding it in anticipation, especially of a Green New Deal and some massive infrastructure spending.
And just your final thoughts, Andrew, on a question you explored recently in terms of how Asia can ensure peace and prosperity for another 60 years amid growing protectionism, decoupling, and climate change. Can a stakeholder focus on ESG and sustainability help in this regard?
Well, I think the lessons of East Asia for the last 60, 70 years is that growth can only grow with political stability. Okay. And the fact that the United States has been a very good friend to East Asia was the anchor of that. But the danger that came up with the last 4 years is that the U.S.-China geopolitical tension has now created many uncertainties in this area. But just think about it. If you really look at the recent visual capitalist map of the world, the largest countries are, you know, from population, China and India. You know, and then you know, America, and then Indonesia, and also Brazil by population, and of course, you know, Indonesia is in East Asia, India so is in India is South Asia, and all these countries are now beginning to move into middle class. They are going to be the engine of growth for the world, whether you like it or not, politically or whatever. The issue that the world has to face is how do you accommodate the demands of the population giants of China and India, and also the, you know, Southeast Asia and South Asia. You know, the Vietnam is 100 million population, Philippines is 100 million population, Bangladesh is nearly 100 million population, Indonesia is 260 million population. These population giants are all moving into middle class, and which will have huge impact on the world in terms of consumption, but also carbon emission and climate change issues. So to a large extent, we need global understanding, you know, that if we want to have conflict, then the world will slowly drift like the 1930s into a global conflict situation. If we actually go for trade and we have a new FDR with a new global Green New Deal, then there is hope. And that's what I'm hoping for, that you know, the new administration in America under Biden will actually revive that direction, rather than, you know, more years of conflict that we've seen under the present administration.
You know, and I know before we started recording, Andrew recently wrote a piece for Project Syndicate, which talks about this and finding the common good. And I think that's very important. And I'm a big fan. My favorite political scientist is Graham Allison, and his recent book and articles about the Thucydides trap and how you don't have to stifle the rise of a new power. There's ways to work with it. And I think that's what Andrew's alluding to. It doesn't always have to be a conflict. And in Andrew's article, he talks about, you know, how he represses China. And I get that, because we point our fingers at China with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And to me, you know, I find that to be such a hypocrisy, because I'm not saying that the Chinese aren't mistreating the Uyghurs. Whatever information we get, it's not good. But who's like one of China's biggest trading? Well, their biggest trading partner in the Mideast is Iran. And Iran runs around the world claiming that they're the protector of all things Islamic, but yet they don't have a problem doing business with China. In fact, they do enormous business with China and look to China. So we sometimes, I'm against all repression of people in the world. I'm against, you know what, my relatives, we have been dealt severe repression at times. And no, these are the issues that have to be dealt with. But we can't just use them as a wedge. We do have to, as Andrew discusses in that Project Syndicate article, we have to find the common good. As he quotes, of all people, the late, and he is a great thinker, Lord Rabbi Sacks, in that idea. So I applaud Andrew's view. I think that is very important. And we do, and I'm not Pollyannish. I understand the world is a harsh and dangerous place. But if you only drive wedges, you make it more so. So finding that commonality, and if it's in climate work and other things that benefit the entire globe, I'm all for it.
Well, great. It's been incredible insight, gentlemen. Thank you so much. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Andrew?
Well, I write for Project Syndicate, and if you, I also write for Asia Newsnet, the articles of which go on the web through South China Morning Post website. Mm-hmm. So these two websites will get you most of my articles. I care a lot about climate change, and I care about peace, and I've come to realize that life is about morality. You know, it's not about utility. Most people forgot about that Adam Smith was a moral philosopher first, and then an economist second. So I think we need to go back to the old books to reclaim our moral bearing.
Yes, excellent. And Ira.
Andrew, I know this has been like a love fest, and we've never met before, we've never talked. But you know what? I always bring that point up, because when I refer to Janet Yellen as a moral philosopher, I do it with great respect. I don't have a problem with that, because Adam Smith was first and foremost a moral philosopher.
Exactly.
But, you know, because he gets quoted out of context. It's like people who quote Schumpeter and all they quote is creative destruction. Well, Schumpeter was much deeper than that. So I applaud you. Where I used to read other stuff, my two reads in the morning are the South China Morning Post and the Financial Times, because I find, you know, just better global stuff there, and I want to see what the Chinese are talking about. So keep doing your great work, and this was really a great pleasure. And this isn't just to talk, because we're trying to draw out, as I say, this isn't gibberish. We're trying to get investable ideas. So thanks for sharing, and I appreciate the time.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.